Welcome to Thursday, the 18th of May. I'm Bill Radke, host of The Record. A medical examiner has now determined that Soundgarden singer Chris Cornell killed himself by hanging in a Detroit hotel room after a concert. Seattle music writer Charles Cross knew Chris Cornell, and Charles will be with us in about 25 minutes. I hope you can stay tuned. We're going to begin this hour with ICE. The Immigration and Customs Enforcement. The mere mention of ICE can send some neighborhoods into a panic. But for one ICE employee in Seattle, it's her job to work with these communities to try to build trust and understanding. It's a relatively new effort for the federal agency, and local groups still are not quite sure what to make of it, as Liz Jones with KUOW's immigration team reports.
A young mom with a stroller takes a seat in front as about 50 people fill the pews at this church in Bellevue on a Thursday morning.
Good morning, everyone.
Many are immigrant advocates, and they're here to talk with Melissa Nitsch. She's a community relations officer with Immigration and Customs Enforcement.
So a little bit about me. I am a Northwest native as well. I grew up.
Nitsch is part of a new team ICE created last year with about 24 officers across the country. The goal is to build support for her agency at the local level, with police, community groups, and the public.
It's definitely an uphill battle, but I get to come to things like this and talk to people and share information.
Nitsch starts with an overview of her work, delicately sidestepping politics.
So, of course, we all know that we had an election and new president who came in with a lot of different ideas from the previous administration.
As policies change, she wants people here to see her as a source of reliable information. Like when rumors fly around about immigration raids, she says to call her. She can check on it.
We don't go out and conduct raids. We're not doing checkpoints. When we are going out to look for somebody, we know who we're looking for.
All eyes are on Nitsch, quietly taking this in. Most here work directly with undocumented families, as city employees, lawyers, school staff, and social workers. Some are immigrants themselves. Nitsch knows this audience likely views her outreach efforts with skepticism, and later, the mom up front calls it out.
Hi, I had a question. I'm sorry this is going to come out sounding really blunt, and I'm not trying to be mean at all, but I do feel that it does need to be said, because I know a lot of us are thinking it.
This woman's a U.S. citizen. Her husband is undocumented, and her question boils down to, why should we trust you?
What can I say to convince you? I don't know. I mean, I'm coming to you knowing that most people here probably don't really like what my agency is doing, but I'm still willing to talk about it with you and answer all your questions, so I hope that that's compelling.
Tension hangs in the air. Nitsch appears a bit nervous, but the meeting continues along politely.
I have two questions. The first question.
Nitsch struggles to be candid, yet also careful with her words. Her job marks a notable shift for ICE, an agency known for staying on script. Afterward, as people leave the church, most say they appreciated the chance to talk directly with an ICE representative.
Yeah. I mean, it fights this notion of a bunch of thugs.
This is Mercer Island resident Phil Gerson. He's part of a church group that helps undocumented immigrants.
I think the speaker did as good a job as she can, but, you know, my questions are, has to do with moral issues.
By that, he means he wants ICE to set clear priorities about who's targeted for deportation. Felons, not families, as some say. One of President Trump's executive orders removed restrictions on ICE enforcement, and people they previously treated as off-limits can now be detained. And it's these undocumented folks who are clearly absent at today's meeting with ICE. Debbie Lacey, one of the organizers, says that's no surprise.
People are so frightened that they're not going to put themselves at risk by actually showing up where they know an ICE person will be, even if we're in a sanctuary.
Lacey is with the Eastside Immigrant and Refugee Coalition. She says this meeting aims to get answers for the immigrants who increasingly turn to them for help. And she's hopeful this dialogue with ICE can continue.
We really wanted to set this up as a safe place for all parties and a place where we could just ask questions, get answers, so that we can advocate and push for people's civil rights at this time.
It's a start, and Lacey sees it as worthwhile. As for trust, that will be tricky between a group that wants to protect immigrants and an agency built up to deport them. I'm Liz Jones, KUOW News.
You're listening to KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. Now time to dive into the big news story today. Once again, the Trump-Russia investigation. The Justice Department has appointed a special counsel to investigate the possibility of a plot with Russia to influence the presidential election. That special counsel is Robert Mueller. He was FBI director under Presidents Bush and Obama. He's considered a highly qualified and bipartisan choice. Here to help you understand what's happening is NPR's national security editor, Phil Ewing. Thank you for doing this, Phil.
Hey, thanks for having me.
What kind of evidence would Robert Mueller have to find to show that the Trump campaign colluded with Russia?
That's a great question, because if you think about it from one perspective, there's already a lot of evidence. There's conversations we know from leaks and official statements and other sources that took place between President Trump's campaign aides and people connected with the Russian government. There's trips that those people allegedly took. And there's already a lot of stuff that's kind of out in the open, but that is not enough to potentially take any kind of legal process forward, apparently. And so one thing that everyone here in Washington, D.C. is watching is what can Mueller discover that's not in the public eye that people don't know? Are there anyone other than the headline names that you might recognize, the campaign aides who are involved in this? And if so, what kind of evidence can he get on them? That might change the conversation if, in fact, there's a lot more to this than we know already from what's been reported in the newspapers.
Well, you mentioned that there have been meetings and conversations among Trump advisors and Russian officials, but I want to play you the sound of the Republican who leads the House Oversight Committee, Jason Chaffetz, on Fox News, saying that there's not evidence of a collusion, and then he doesn't fear this investigation.
Look, I have not seen any evidence of actual collusion. Where is the actual crime that they think they need a special prosecutor to prosecute? I haven't seen that. There's been a lot of flailing, but that flailing started before January 20th.
What do you think about that assessment, Phil, that there's no evidence of the big crime colluding with Russia? This is mostly just a flailing White House.
Well, you don't know what you don't know. So there's a couple ways to respond to what he said, or I should say there's a couple ways to view those comments. We normal people out in the public who are just trying to go about our lives and do our jobs don't know what classified evidence exists behind the scenes, what America's intelligence agencies know from their intercepts, the National Security Agency, the FBI, the CIA. They've been mixed up in this for a long time. And before he was fired, FBI Director James Comey said its counterintelligence investigation had been taking place since last July. So there's a lot, as intelligence government people say, on the high side here that we have not seen in the public. Also, there's a lot of smoke, as the top Democrat on the Senate Intelligence Committee keeps saying. The Republican National Committee did change its platform in Cleveland last year to soften support for American assistance to Ukraine, which Russia invaded. And so Chaffetz isn't wrong when he said maybe there's no smoking gun evidence of a crime, but there's a lot of circumstantial evidence. There's a lot of other things that people in this world point to that indicate that they believe it's appropriate for somebody like Robert Mueller to come in and drive the train on this investigation. Again, a lot of this will depend on what he uncovers and what eventually gets made public based on what the government knows but is still classified.
Phil, it's interesting you say there's a lot of smoke, because Mueller's not only supposed to look for coordination between Russia and the Trump campaign, but also, quote, any matters that may arise directly from the investigation. So could he also prosecute leaks, prosecute obstruction of justice?
That's entirely possible. And one of the things that is in the scope of his investigation, and Republicans have talked about since the beginning of this, is how is all this information getting into the New York Times and Washington Post and on the wire services and all of the other news agencies who've been covering this that you've been reading about? And I don't know, and I don't know if Mueller knows, because he's still very new in this job, how much of that he'll get into. But what Republican members of Congress, including Chaffetz, who we heard from, and others on the intelligence committees have said, is that they're could be wrongdoing on the part of the previous administration, the Obama administration. They've laid the blame at former National Security Advisor Susan Rice, whom they have accused of abusing her power to look at classified material and then potentially release it to the press. Now, Rice has denied that she's done anything wrong, and Democrats say that that's just a sideshow, that's a smokescreen that the administration and its allies have created to distract from what the real issues here are, they argue. So we don't know exactly where this will lead, but that's one of the things that could potentially be dangerous for everyone in town. You know, this is an unguided weapon, and no one knows where it's going to land.
We're talking with NPR's national security editor, Phil Ewing, who's been following this story. Phil, as special counsel, Robert Mueller works for the Justice Department. Couldn't President Trump fire him like he fired the FBI director?
It would be very dicey politically for that to take place, but that is absolutely correct. President Trump enjoys the privilege and the power to relieve all these leaders at the Justice Department and the FBI and the other agencies in the federal government who serve at his pleasure, who are the top-level political appointees. But the official line from the White House and its allies has been, if this leads to a resolution to this matter in a way that makes it go away, because they argue there's no basis here, there's nothing for these investigators to find, so much the better. Or at least that was their initial reaction last night. This morning, President Trump took a different tone on Twitter. He has called this a witch hunt. He denies there's any merit to the story. And he's called himself the most prosecuted politician in history. I should say the most persecuted politician in history. And we will just have to see. Only time will tell. But yes, it is true that if things got to a point where they felt it wasn't going well or there were some other issues they wanted to resolve, Trump does have that power to get rid of the deputy attorney general and potentially this special counsel as well.
We've been talking about Russia interfering with our election. So does this investigation include everything after the election, Russians meeting with Jeff Sessions and Michael Flynn, et cetera? Is that part of Robert Mueller's job?
What I think he will do is at some point establish a timeline of how this worked, because there's the aspect that we hear most often about that could potentially concern President Trump and his campaign aides, but there's the bigger picture of the story that took place last year, and that's also part of this. The congressional committees are looking into that. I think Robert Mueller's investigation probably also will look into that, because you can't tell one story without telling the other. And the other is much better documented. That's something the U.S. intelligence communities have written about in an unclassified way in a big document they released at the beginning of this year, in which they said they believe with high confidence, in their phrase, the Russians interfered with hacking and leaks and social media meddling and trolls and all the other things a lot of us remember from last year, first to hurt Hillary Clinton and then to help Donald Trump eventually become elected. And I wouldn't be surprised if when Mueller does his final report or whatever comes out of this process, we learn even more about that than we know today from those previous Intelligence Committee reports.
Okay, that's a snapshot of where we are on this Trump-Russia investigation. Thanks to NPR's national security editor, Phil Ewing. Thanks a lot, Phil.
My pleasure.
KUOW's The Record continues in just a moment. Thank you for tuning in. I'm Bill Radke. My Family's Slave. That's the title of the cover story of The Atlantic magazine. Former Seattle Times reporter Alex Tizon wrote the story before he died 2 months ago. The woman he called a slave was Eudoxia Tomas Polito. Alex and his brothers and sisters and his mom called her Lola. Lola cleaned, she cooked, she raised the children, but she was never paid, and she didn't think leaving was an option. Alex says he was about 11 when he realized Lola's status in his family, but it took him years to come to terms with it. I spoke to Alex's widow, Melissa Tizon, who says she first met Lola 20 years ago before she married Alex.
I knew that she was a distant relative. I knew that she wasn't quite a grandmother, more like a great aunt, which is not uncommon in Filipino families to have some distant relative living with you.
Melissa says it wasn't until last year when she read a draft of Alex's article that she saw the word slave used to describe who Lola was.
And it's not a word that any of the brothers and sisters ever used or ever even considered until Alex started exploring this story. The word slave didn't come up in his discussions until about a year ago. But you know, the family did see that she was treated very poorly, mistreated by the parents. The kids were so upset about it. And it was always a struggle and a tension in their household growing up.
When you learn, Melissa, about how Lola was lied to, she was told she would be paid, and she never was. She didn't think she was free to leave. She was whipped with a belt, for example, for the behavior of a child she was caring for. How did learning all of that change the way you thought about Lola?
Oh, I was heartbroken. Those stories I learned about when I read the draft.
The draft of Alex's story.
Yeah, Alex's story. And it was just the way everybody feels. I mean, there is no excuse for it. It's disturbing. And to think that happened to a woman that I loved and lived with for 12 years was just, it was, I cried as I read that whole article.
Yes, Lola came to live with you eventually, you and Alex. And what was the situation like for Lola in your home?
Well, so when the brothers and Alex's brothers and sisters were old enough to understand what was going on and in a position to help Lola, you know, they had grown up, gotten out of high school. They really wanted to help her get out of the situation, get into something better. They offered her a lot of options, you know, over the years, and said, you know, we'll help you get back to the Philippines. We can help you, and this way you can come live with us. But she never felt like she could do that because she was so devoted to Alex's mom. So she never felt like she could leave until Alex's mom passed away in 1999.
Well, at some point she was not, for many of those years at least, she wasn't a citizen. She was undocumented here, right? I mean, didn't she feel compelled to stay in some sense?
Yeah, that I'm sure that had something to do with it. I mean, I don't know, but I can't speculate on it, but that would have had something to do with it, I'm sure.
What was the arrangement with Lola when she lived with you?
Well, so when Alex's mom passed away in 1999, the brothers and sisters presented her with different options of where she could live and what she could do, offered to have her go back to the Philippines to live with her family, and we would help her get there, or she could have lived with any of the siblings. And she chose to live with Alex and me. And at the time, we were living in Edmonds, Washington. And we welcomed her into our home. We wanted her to live with us. We wanted her to enjoy the rest of her life as much as she could. At that point, she was in her 70s, and we just wanted to make the best of it for her. We knew, like, I didn't know all the details, but I knew she had a very, very difficult life, and it was time for her to enjoy and to rest and to just do what she loved to do. So in our home, she was never forced to do anything. In fact, Alex always had to tell her to please you don't have to do that. But we quickly realized that there were some things that she just loved doing. She loved cooking for us. She was an amazing cook. And the entire family loved, we loved her food. So that was one of the things that she always did. And at our home in Edmonds, we also had Alex's brothers and sisters lived nearby in the neighborhood. So we had nieces and nephews coming over all the time, and they loved being around Lola, and she loved being around them. And it was just, for us, it was just so fun to have that experience all together and to see Lola just relax and have fun. And so I think it was a different lifestyle for her than what she had experienced all those years before.
But from another point of view, she was cooking for you. She was doing childcare, mm-hmm. cleaning as well.
Yeah.
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 Was she paid?
Yes, we did pay her. And we also didn't force her to do any of that. If she wanted to do that, she just didn't want to sit around the house. You know, and we also had our kids in childcare as well. So, I mean, it was kind of a mix of just helping
out.
Yeah.
Yeah. And this is part of where it gets complicated, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, you could imagine that someone who'd lived Lola's life, that if you want to call it slavery, as Alex did, that can warp your sense of what your choices are. You know, it can be mm-hmm. a kind of trauma. Did you and Alex consider, look, whether she wants to or not, we're going to set her up in her own home. It's going to cost us a lot of money, but we're going to sort of quote unquote free her as much as we can. Did you consider that?
We didn't. I don't think we considered that option specifically because, I don't know that she never expressed that as something that she wanted to be alone because she'd always been with people. One option that we explored a lot, many times, was having her go back to the Philippines to be with her family, and we had had her try it a few times. So we brought her back there and would have her stay like a month or 2 months at a time, just to see if she wanted to live there for the rest of her life. And it turned out that she always wanted to come back home to be with us. she wanted to be with a family, with so that was the option that we explored seriously, but she chose not to.
We're talking with Melissa Tizon, and her late husband, Alex, wrote this piece in the Atlantic magazine about his family having owned a slave, and Alex died just before the piece came out, and it's gotten a whole lot of reaction, Melissa, and some negative reaction. These are some of the comments people have made online. The piece attempts to humanize the slavers and centers them in the story. Nothing but a man's attempt to justify himself for doing nothing. It seemed like the writer was processing his emotions, not actually creating any change. It was self-serving. What have you made of the blowback, the angry reaction to your late husband?
You know, I think the way Lola was treated by Alex's parents is something to be mad about. And it's something that Alex was angry about his whole life and wrestled with, didn't really understand it. So I completely understand why people are having that reaction.
And Melissa, can you understand the reaction that people have, that you're romanticizing how well she did work for Alex's family and for your family, that in a sense maybe she didn't feel free to have a whole other life.
Mm-hmm.
Do you understand why it's difficult to honor the work she did and how good she was at work?
Mm-hmm.
You know,
yeah.
What does that feel like for you?
I don't feel like any of it is romantic, because her life was so arduous. She had such a difficult life, and yet, you know, despite her situation in life, she rose above it, and just was still this incredible human being despite all the suffering that she went through. And I think if that's romanticizing, you know, then I don't see what's wrong with that, because it shows us, you know, what the human spirit can do.
I had the impression reading the article that Alex wanted to bring the twisted reality of slavery into today, to make it more relatable in a way. Because we're talking about Confederate monuments, right? Coming down in New Orleans into a Northerner, it's almost convenient to think of it as something that happened to other people a long time ago, but he brought slavery into our homes in a way. Do you think that why do you think it was important for Alex to portray this as slavery?
I think he wanted to be as honest with himself as he possibly could about what the situation was. And so that's why I don't see it as romanticizing, because slavery is the most inflammatory word that you could use to describe a situation. But it's also the most accurate word. You know, after really looking back at the relationship and the way that she was treated, that is the most accurate word. And so I think he just wanted to be honest about it. And, I think he wanted to tell the story to the world, but he also wanted to come to grips with what he was feeling. I think that he wanted to bring Lola's story to the world. So I know that there is this bigger issue of human trafficking and slavery that is so important for us to be talking about as a country and recognizing that it exists. But I also know that bringing Lola's story to the world was important to him and his understanding of who she was in his life.
Melissa, you've said that every family has something they're ashamed of. What do you mean by that as it relates to Lola?
Well, I don't think everyone has a Lola story, yeah. Obviously. So people can't necessarily relate to that. But people have things in their family that they're not proud of. It could be addiction. It could be abuse. It could be just things that they just choose not to talk about and not to face. And it just becomes this hidden secret in their families. And the thing about Alex is that he was not afraid to face those. It took him a long time. It took him a lifetime to understand what was really happening with Lola and what his relationship with her was. But he had the courage to dive deep and come to that. And that's what I hope people can relate to is, so even though they may not be able to relate to our specific situation, I think that there's something in their lives that they could probably say that I kind of know what it's like to feel ashamed about something in my family and have not said anything about it to people before.
Well, and there's another layer to that when we're going from alcoholism and the horror of that to exploiting another human being who just had one life on this, mm-hmm. in this world.
Yeah. You know, I don't want to compare the two of human exploitation and alcoholism. I don't want to compare the two. I just wanted to make the point about being able to dive into the shame and the secrets that families often have.
Melissa, what do you want us to take away from Lola's story, Alex's story, this human story?
With Alex passing away recently, this was a story that he had wanted to tell for the last 4 to 5 years, and really struggled with it personally and emotionally. And it just took a lot of soul searching to get there. And he believed that every person had an epic story. And he always wrote stories about the forgotten people, the marginalized. And Lola was that person in our home that he just wanted to make sure was not forgotten and not honored. So I just wanted to make sure that story got out into the world. And I know there are people criticizing it, but I just think it was important. And the Atlantic gave our family a choice. They said, you know, we understand if you don't want to move forward with it. But I thought it was important. His brothers and sisters thought it was important. And so we did. And it's brought about a lot of conversation, a whole range of reaction that's been negative and positive. And I think that's exactly what Alex would have wanted. He would have wanted a discussion around it. He would have embraced it. He would have dove right in to talk with the critics and answer their questions. And I wish he was here to do that, because it's all kind of sort of left unsaid now. But the story is out there, and I think it's an important one to have been told, and one that only he could have told.
Melissa Tizon, I'm sorry again about Alex's passing, and thank you for coming in here and confronting this history. Thank you.
Thank you.
Complicated story, sad story. I would love to know what you think of all of this. Send us an email if you have reflections. record@kuow.org. Black hole sun, won't you come? Wash away the rain. Black hole sun, won't you come? Won't you come? More sad news to report. If you haven't heard, Chris Cornell has died. The Soundgarden frontman was found dead last night, hours after the band played a show in Detroit. The Associated Press is reporting the medical examiners ruled his death a suicide. Charles R. Cross is an author and a former editor of the Seattle magazine The Rocket, and he's known Chris Cornell for how long did you know him, Charles?
30 years.
30 years. What do you know about what happened?
Well, I don't know about what happened in Detroit other than what I've read online. And the weird part is that's actually the first Soundgarden music I've heard today. You know, woke up, saw the text, and now to hear that voice and to hear that music again, it's just so devastating. You know, this is the second saddest day in Seattle music history, the first, of course, being in April of 1994. But to even get to the studio, I have to drive by the apartment building that Lane Staley died at. Mm. So if you add Lane, Kurt, Chris, Andy Wood, who died of unintentional drug overdose, who was Chris Cornell's roommate, we're talking about a pretty long, sad legacy of death, addiction, and suicide in Seattle music.
Death, addiction, suicide, music, Seattle. Like, yeah, that's a lot. That's a legacy. What do you make of that?
Well, and it's not all that. You know, I knew Chris pretty well. I bet I interviewed him 20 or more times over the years, saw Soundgarden at some of their very first shows. A lot of the discussions that when he and I talked were about addiction, death, losing Andy Wood, losing Kurt Cobain, losing Lane Staley. These were heavy losses for him to bear. Yet he and Soundgarden were not just about that. We're playing Black Hole Sun and Fell on Black Days. There's a lot of melancholy in their songs. That's part of what his personality was. But that's not the only thing. Soundgarden was also a very celebratory band. When they first came out, they were sort of routinely criticized as being Led Zeppelin clones. Chris performed almost universally with his shirt off. He has better pecs than I do, which is saying a lot. Mm. And he had incredible hair. And he frankly had one of the greatest voices that any Seattle rock star has ever had.
Yeah, to the point, on KUOW's Facebook page, Ted wrote, Soundgarden was the one that just rocked out. They were more like a new school heavy metal band versus Nirvana, Pearl Jam, etc. Where do you put that?
Absolutely. Soundgarden early on were metal, you know, and also people forget a few parts of Soundgarden's history. First, Seattle band signed to a major label from that era. They were on three labels before they became famous. They were on SST, Sub Pop, and finally on A&M. They also broke through later than any of those other bands, which people also forget. They're the first of those bands to start to begin, but they don't really break through until 1994. Even when Nirvana took off and Pearl Jam, Soundgarden was not selling boatloads of records until the release of their incredible Super Unknown album, and that took off and made them the biggest band in the land for a while.
I know this is the first you're hearing of their music today since you found out. I just want to hear a little more music. You mentioned Black Days, Fell on Black Days off of Super Unknown.
Okay, we got to stop playing this. It's a little, unfortunately, that song and some of this, it's a little too real to some degree, because the lyrics of this song and so much of what Soundgarden's music about is this story sort of today. It feels really raw to listen to that. You know, everybody has a darkness inside them that they don't always show. And one of Chris's gifts as a singer was that you could hear that. When he opened his mouth, you could hear that darkness. And that's one of the reasons people related to him. And that's one of the reasons Soundgarden had so many fans, is that his voice has that melancholy in it if he were singing Happy Birthday. It's just part of the gift that he had as a singer.
Talking with Seattle music writer Charles Cross, you know, sometimes we talk about a rock and roll icon commits suicide, and we just put this fable onto it that we think we know, but human beings kill themselves sometimes, and they I also want to talk about, did you know what he was struggling with? Do you know whether he was getting help? Do you know whether the Seattle music scene was, you know, putting their arms around
him? Interrupt you. Yes, yeah. yes. But, you know, you mentioned the story. 30,000 people in America kill themselves in a given year. The number of people who suffer from depression and struggle with addiction is you know, almost a majority of our society these days. There are resources. They don't always work. They don't always help. We don't know what somebody goes on inside their own mind at a given time. Chris was open at talking about that he'd had some struggles with drugs over the years. He was open in talking about having struggles with depression. These are not secrets that are coming out today. This is not necessarily a news story. This is a tragedy that happens every day in America. When a rock star dies, then people suddenly become aware of it. But if 30,000 people are dying, it's an epidemic in this society, and it needs to be something we more normalize.
Beautifully said. Thank you for that. Let's talk a little bit more before we go about music. You mentioned, we've said a little bit about this, but I just want to bring it home. What do you think Chris Cornell did for the Seattle music scene?
Well, he really is where everything sort of began. Soundgarden's really the first band of that era. I was editor of a magazine called The Rocket. We worked out of Belltown. Soundgarden began in Belltown. I saw some of those early shows. I'm not exactly sure if the statistics are right, but I'm almost positive that Soundgarden was on the cover of The Rocket more than any other band. So you have the local music magazine. Soundgarden is covered more than any other band. But it was a long time we were screaming about how great they were before anybody else in the rest of the world paid attention. They were an unbelievably dynamic live band in the late 80s. They were incredible live. Not just Chris's singing, Kim Thiel's guitar playing, Ben Shepherd's bass playing, Matt Cameron's drumming, who drums in Pearl Jam as well. They were incredible live band. They were almost more of a Seattle band than any of these other bands. Nirvana was from Aberdeen. Eddie Vedder came in from San Diego, but joined guys in Seattle. But Soundgarden was Seattle. This was the most Seattle of any Seattle band, in my argument.
And what do you think Chris Cornell's legacy is outside of this city? What do you think he'll be remembered
for? Well,
an
incredible legacy. Not only did he perform with Soundgarden, he also did the Temple of the Dog album, which is one of the greatest honors to anybody that ever died. The weird part is his greatest artistic work is Temple of the Dog. And that's an album of a song suite he did for his roommate, Andy Wood, who died. So in some ways, it's his same. He did it for Andy, but in some ways, it also speaks very deeply about Chris's death. And that's what I guess I would want to go to musically. But remember, Chris was also an Audio Slave, which was a huge band on his own. Yep. He had a successful solo career. The shows he played, I think it's last November at the Paramount, the two Temple of the Dog shows, the hardest ticket to get in Seattle music history. I mean, that was the hardest ticket there ever has been to any show ever in Seattle. And that shows you the fact that even 30 years after his career began, he commanded that kind of respect among Seattle music fans. It's no great exaggeration to say that, you know, Chris Cornell will be deeply missed by people in Seattle who loved his music, but his musical legacy will last far beyond Seattle fans.
Charles Cross, author, former editor of the Seattle magazine, The Rocket. Again, Chris Cornell died last night, age 52, best known for Soundgarden, Temple of the Dog, Audio Slave. The medical examiner has ruled that a suicide. KEXP will have a memorial and a moment of silence at their radio station today at Seattle Center. That's open to the public, and it starts at 5 o'clock. I want to leave the last word to Ari, who on our Facebook page says, my dad would have 107.7 The End playing on the way to the Stillaguamish River summer afternoons. I have distinct memories of My Wave playing as we cross one of the bridges over the Stille and Oso, the river sparkling and the sun shining. These are soundtracks of our childhood, adolescence, and adulthood. I believe they have a profound influence on the people we are today. Charles Cross, thank you for this.
Thank you. I just cannot friggin' believe it. I just can't believe it.
You're listening to KUOW. I just want to remind you that there is help, the National Suicide Hotline. We've unfortunately said it many times, 800-273-8255, 800-273-TALK. This is KUOW FM Seattle, KUOW Tumwater, KQOW Bellingham, and Digital HD Services. Oh, you are me.
elected to serve the Washington media or special interests. I got elected to serve the forgotten men and women of our country, and that's what I'm doing.
President Trump talking about his relationship with the media. And our next guest writes about Trump and media in her new book, The Trouble with Reality. Brooke Gladstone is co-host of WNYC's On the Media. Brooke, welcome.
Nice to be here.
Trump's critics don't like his disregard for facts, but as a media critic, you want us to remember that facts are not reality. What do you mean by that?
Well, facts are not all there is to reality. I mean, reality is a mixture of facts, you know, the seen world, things we can observe, things we can prove, evidence, all marinated and mixed up and filtered through a bunch of values and traditions and community and preferences, and what they combine to create is the reality that each of us lives in, which is different from objective reality, which we can never know because it's far too complex. We would be paralyzed by it. We are just feeble little human beings with five senses, and we cannot know the world. So we have to build our own little replicas of them and live in there. And many important things get left out of the little apartment-sized reality we build for ourselves.
Okay, our brains are not designed to understand the world accurately. We form our own stereotyped pictures. And you write about how President Trump mirrored his supporters' mental map of reality and validated it.
Absolutely. I mean, if you feel completely absent of facts, if your reality, which is built on a web of beliefs, all of ours are, said that the country is changing in a way that you don't like, that you're not going to be able to pass on to your kids what you had, that doom is coming and you're left behind. You know, if you have Trump saying, yes, I see that too, and here's why, and he offers a list of villains that include violence in the inner city and so on, and immigrants and all kinds of things, and say, this, none of this is your fault. I can fix it. You and I both know that the system is rigged, but I can rig it for you for once. People say, all right, I'll take that deal. Even if your assertions don't match the facts, it doesn't really matter. The facts haven't served us. But your picture of reality feels true because it validates ours, and we're present in it. And many people were not present in the realities that many of us have lived in very complacently for years and years.
You write about how powerful that is, someone validating your mental map of reality. You get into the brain science of that.
Yeah, it's pretty fascinating. I quote an fMRI study that was done by Drew Weston, who is an Emory University professor, in 2006. What they did is they took Democrats and Republicans and they hooked them up to fMRIs, and then they showed them, for instance, the Democrat. They would show them a Republican lying, and a Democrat could process that really well, you know, the opposite case with Republicans, and their reasoning centers would light up. But when a Democrat or Republican was confronted with a lie from somebody of their own party, someone on their team, the reasoning centers went completely dark. And what lit up were the conflict centers, a part of the brain, I think it's called the anterior cingulate. And it was just, you know, pumping out danger, danger, danger. And the only way they could get out of that sense of conflict was to figure out a way to reconcile the lie, right? And once they did, they got a shot of dopamine, the same thing that basically any one of us would get if we took cocaine. So fundamentally, we are wired to lie to ourselves to keep our realities consistent and unimpaired. It is a sickening thing, a physically sickening thing, to have your universe shaken up. And that's the position many of us are in now.
Brooke Gladstone of On the Media writes about, in this case, how wired we are to lie to ourselves. Brooke, the media report on Trump's lies, but you think they miss the point. Why is that?
First of all, there is a sense that with this kind of discounting of the media, Trump has given permission for his constituents to simply ignore facts that they don't want to believe, facts that threaten their worldview. He says that the media, which was regarded from the days of the nation's founding as one of the ways we get an informed electorate, that truth will triumph over falsehood, that all of that is simply not the case, that you need to keep your world safe. You listen to me. I will validate you. I will help you get where you want to go. And it doesn't really matter what I say. And by saying, you can choose what to believe or not to believe, you're not under any obligation to believe facts, then basically they're saying, you can make up any story that you want, and I will validate it if you will validate mine. And the media offer you nothing. They just have their own agenda. The truth itself is not knowable. Everybody lies. All you have to do is pick what you want. And this is where the danger to democracy comes in, because democracy is essentially a negotiation. People work from a common pool of facts. They try to get their own policies enacted, but they're working from the same page. He's saying that there is no negotiation. It's not possible because we can't believe together certain basic truths. And therefore, that mechanism falls apart, and that opens the door to authoritarianism. Did you follow me there? Was I too fast?
Yes, because when we can't believe in truth, it's not knowable, we are paralyzed, and so we can be pushed around.
Mm-hmm. Basically, Ned Reznikoff said this in Think Progress. By degrading the very notion of shared reality, Trump disabled the engine of democracy. Reznikoff wrote, when the truth is little more than an arbitrary personal decision, there's no common ground to be reached and no incentive to look for it.
The book is The Trouble with Reality, a rumination on moral panic in our time. The writer is On the Media's Brooke Gladstone. Brooke, a Trump supporter might say you are so deep in the mainstream media that you're desperately hanging on to the reality that your brain is invested in.
Well, that's fair. I would say that what I'm trying to do in the book is to explain how all of us build our realities, to identify as clearly as I can the rhetorical techniques that Trump has used throughout his career as a businessman long before he was a politician, and how well they suited these times. I also blame ourselves, that is to say, those who share bubbles similar to mine, for being blind and for ignoring vast swaths of the nation. And I advocate very strongly for people to get out of their bubbles, or at least peer over the walls a little bit to see what's going on elsewhere, if only so they can reconstruct their realities along more durable lines.
I was interested, Brooke, that you're making a kind of psychological case for getting out of the bubble. Do you talk about that there's a path to comprehension that lowers your blood pressure and makes you more helpful, more useful or something?
Well, you know, the fact is, taking action can be a solace. I don't offer any, you know, comfort in the sense of, oh, it's all going to be all right. I think we're entering new territory. But we always enter new territory. As the saying goes, you can't stand in the same river twice. It's always changing. This is a new era, a new time, a new technology, a new leader, and a new challenge to democracy. And it's something that every single citizen needs to pay attention to. But the thing is that what everybody can do is to venture out just a little bit. Find a view that is not yours, that is reasonably expressed and fact-based, and just read, just see. I mean, if it's possible, go to those places where you've never been, where people who are very much unlike you have lives that are very different from your own. Just take a look. I'm not asking anybody to compromise their values and their principles or even change their mind. I'm merely asking people to make an effort just to look. That's all.
Brooke Gladstone co-hosts WNYC's On the Media, and she's the author of the new book, The Trouble with Reality, A Rumination on Moral Panic in Our Time. Brooke, it's been a pleasure talking with you. Thank you.
Same here. Thanks, Bill.
Early this morning, President Trump tweeted about the investigations into his campaign's possible collusions with Russia. He writes, "This is the single greatest witch hunt of a politician in American history." You're listening to The Record on KUOW 94.9 Seattle. I'm Bill Radke. Thanks for listening today. You know, a few minutes ago, I had a very powerful conversation with Melissa Tizon about her late husband Alex's story of their family's slave, Lola. I asked you what you thought, and Julie wrote us at record@kuow.org and said, "I think it was brave of the author and his family to make this story public. Let us not judge them. Best to shine a light on painful issues. I will not forget the story of Lola. I will not forget the little boy who grew up and enlightened himself and us. I will not forget his grieving wife struggling to shoulder critics' feedback and to honor her husband's journey. Sincere thanks for making this segment." Thank you for listening, Julie. Also, we talked about slavery yesterday when we told you about Confederate monuments coming down in New Orleans and asked what the University of Washington should do about its statue of George Washington, U.S. president and slave owner. A listener named Nick heard that conversation and writes, "It's hard for me to take seriously concerns about a statue of George Washington while seemingly nobody bats an eyelid at a huge statue of mass murderer Lenin in Fremont." We love to hear from you about any of the conversations we're having here on KUOW, so talk to us, record@kuow.org, or on Twitter or Facebook. Call us, if that's your thing, 206-221-3663. President Trump's about to speak at the White House, a joint news conference with the Colombian president, and we'll bring that to you on KUOW as soon as it happens.